How do we manage victims of abuse and advocate for them in front of our peers? We're going to have abuse victim advocate Kim McCaffrey on the show this week to share her thoughts and some important lessons we can all share for these at-risk patients. So if that's what you're looking for, you found it right here on this week's special episode of the MedicCast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the MediCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I just want to, as always, welcome you to this week's show. We've got a great show for you. It's a special episode. I have a full episode segment on victim advocacy and human trafficking. You know, most of us know very little about how to care for these fragile patients. We might have an idea on how to treat their physical injuries and problems, but what about the emotional scars, the psychological problems, the social issues that are underlying the scene beneath the surface? Well, that's what we're going to delve into in this special episode, so stay tuned. Before we get to all that, though, as always, I want to make sure you check out the links that I'll have for you about more information on this topic over at the MedicCast blog at medicast.com/blog. There's a show notes link at the top of the page, so click that link, and it'll take you right to the most recent episode, or you can scroll down there and find previous episodes as well. There's also a search box there for you on the right-hand side if you're looking for something in particular, but take some time. Make sure you follow up on the information, especially this week, so that you understand how what we're talking about this week applies to your EMS practice and protocols. If you do want to get back in touch with me, maybe you still have a question or you want to touch base, well, you can email me at podmedic@mac.com and email me your comments, your thoughts about an episode like this one. Maybe you want to send me a suggestion or an interview idea for a future episode. Either way, I'll work hard getting back to you, so I respond back to all the emails that come in, and I'll get back to you as well. So that's it for our contact information. It's time to get on into the rest of the show. That is coming up with Kim McCaffrey in just a sec. My guest today, Kimberly McCaffrey, has served as sexual assault prevention coordinator in the nonprofit sector since 2011. Prior to accepting this role, she held the position of victim advocate, and she worked with survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence all the time. She's trained members of the U.S. military, law enforcement agencies, public safety agencies, youth-serving organizations, and businesses about a variety of topics having to do with victim advocacy. These topics include things like media literacy and rape culture, child sexual abuse prevention, human sex trafficking information, violence prevention, and victim advocacy and volunteer training. Throughout her career, she has chaired things like county coalitions for violence prevention and has served as a director on the board of the Philadelphia Children's Alliance, the city's accredited child advocacy center. Kim also happens to be a very old friend of mine, and I'm glad she reached out to me to do this particular episode so we can focus on this important topic. Now, while we'll just be scratching the surface, hopefully you'll get something out of this episode to give you a starting point from which you can seek out other opportunities to follow up and educate yourself with local resources in your community. So here's my segment with Kim on abuse victim advocacy and human trafficking. Hi, Kim. Welcome to the show. And, you know, folks probably don't know that we have known each other for a long time, but strangely enough, it never really occurred to me to discuss this particular topic of victim advocacy and how to manage abuse victims in the EMS and nursing setting until you reached out to me on Facebook and said, hey, we should do this. So thanks so much for taking the initiative and kicking me upside the head and getting me to do this segment.
I'm excited to even have you starting this conversation. I'm excited to be a part of it. I think it's important information, and I think one that we should be having more often within the first responder and healthcare world.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And we were talking before we started recording that, you know, this is something that we get very little, if any, education on in any healthcare setting. I've seen a little bit more about it recently in nursing circles, but not as much as I think really needs to be done. And it's certainly not part of any kind of organized curriculum that every nurse is getting or every EMT or paramedic is getting. So let's start off with who we're going to talk about. Let's define our population of patients here.
Sure. So we're looking at a unique group of people that would be patients either in a hospital setting, healthcare setting, or with first responders. So we're looking at domestic violence, sexual violence, which of course would be sexual assault or rape, and also victims of human trafficking. So we're going to look kind of like at those three groups.
Excellent. So let's start off with that initial contact, whether you're an EMT or paramedic or nurse. I think we all come from a caring population of providers. We want to provide care. We want to be caring. But we need to maintain this professional distance and make sure that we're handling these patients appropriately so we don't make them more uncomfortable. Sure. So let's start at the very beginning. You know, what are some of the things we're looking for? What are some of the things that we are going to use to help us identify these patients?
Sure. So if we look exclusively at victims of domestic violence, often, if you are a first responder, there's probably going to be serious injuries. Often, victims of domestic violence do not seek health care unless there is something that is life-threatening. I've advocated for people that have endured broken elbows and have needed stitches and have not sought health care. So you're going to be looking at somebody that has some significant injuries. So just even seeking that level of treatment, it goes without saying that they are very afraid. They know that or might anticipate that there are going to be repercussions for seeking that treatment at that time. And we really want to talk to first responders specifically to be able to say, you know, this isn't the time to, you know, we don't want you to advocate for them. We don't want you to, you know, provide crisis counseling. We want you to be able to focus on your role, whether that's law enforcement, firefighters, EMTs, and paramedics. We want you to focus on your role. So we don't want you to comfort or even like pity that individual. But there are things that you can do and really things that you shouldn't do that you don't even need to worry about to be able to really just give that person quality treatment and a moment to catch their breath. But things that you're going to want to look for, obviously, are going to be like these serious injuries. Strangulation. You're going to see bruises around the throat. You're going to see like other injuries that really just kind of go in line with domestic violence. But what we want to kind of really bring your attention to is if the perpetrator of the domestic violence is going to be present, often they might want to accompany that patient to the hospital or going to kind of insert themselves into that situation where it's not appropriate. And that creates an unsafe space for your patient. However, it also creates an unsafe space for the first responder. So it's really kind of a good idea to even really not question anybody around how did this happen. If you think that they are a victim of domestic violence, because for them to articulate that might create a further unsafe space for them and then also for the first responder as well.
Yeah, and that's important to keep in mind because one of the things that we actually work into our assessment, especially in trauma victims, is the mechanism of the injury. How did it happen? And if we suspect abuse, that's an important note to make that we should be very careful when stepping into that topic. We need to understand certainly the mechanics of it in order to do our job, but only to the extent that it's going to affect our treatment of the patient, I think is important.
I think if there's any opportunity to separate the person that someone might believe is the perpetrator to whether you even have to be dishonest, like, well, it's against our policy to have you ride with us, or it's per our policy, this, that, or the other. And if that person expresses like, well, I'm not okay with that and I'm going to accompany this person, so, you know, I totally understand that. I get it. I know that you're worried about them. What you can do is if you want to call the administrator that kind of created that policy to see if you kind of get, you know, talk to them later about that. We certainly welcome you to do that. However, at this time, it's against our policy and actually it would be against the law for you to be in here with us. So defer that, you know, to somebody else to quickly kind of separate that person so that you can, capture that data that you need and the information from your patient that you need to treat.
Okay, that's good to know. Sometimes, I mean, people might think in an ambulance setting, for instance, that it's okay to put the person up front in the passenger seat. We often let passengers ride up front. and not in the back. But that's still not really a safe space, right? We need to understand that just because they're just a few feet away may cause additional issues.
Correct, especially if they are able to participate in the conversation between the first responder and the patient, or they can hear what the patient says, then that's not going to be a safe space for anybody involved. Okay. But even if they can't hear, if the front cab is separate from, you know, depending on what vehicle is being used, I would still suggest not, because your patient doesn't know that person can't hear. So therefore, they're not going to be potentially not be honest with their answers.
Okay, good to know. But you know, even if we suspect that they aren't being honest with their answers to us, this isn't a time to dig. Am I correct?
Correct. Yeah, they're going to give you what they want to give you in that moment, and we really, you know, even as an advocate, we do not push them to disclose anything. We don't push them. We just tell them their options. These are the options that are available to you. If you would like us to involve law enforcement, we can do that. But you're in the driver's seat here. This is their time to give you what they can give you. And they will give you everything they are capable of giving you in that moment. They're not holding back because it's fun but they are giving you what they feel is safe to give you in that moment.
Okay, so we just need to use the information we have, use our eyes and ears and our other assessment techniques to make decisions about treatment. We're not going to necessarily get all the information we need from the patient themselves.
Correct. But the more of a safe space that can be created, and if somebody feels that this is a domestic violence related injury, you can say, I want you to know that this is a safe space. Nobody can hear what we're saying, just you and I. It's not confidential. I'll be sharing this with the hospital when we get there. But I want you to know that nobody else can hear. Almost communicating, you can talk about things here, especially if you feel like they are holding back. Articulating, not saying like, I think you're a victim of domestic violence. I want you to know this is a safe space. Just saying that this is a safe space. You can talk to me. And we're not going to be sharing that with anybody outside of the hospital staff.
So don't make any accusations that they can either deny or affirm. You don't want to put them in that position. You just want to let them know that it is safe. It is a safe location for them.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
And this is something that nurses are doing in the ER, at least somewhat, that they, do you feel safe when you're at home is a newer assessment question that is asked during triage of patients. But the challenge for nurses in that setting is I don't think they have anything to go up if the answer is no. I mean, they get this question to ask, but there's not a whole lot of training that comes back when they're in a safe location and getting that answer back that says, no, I don't feel safe at home. What do you do next? What's the next step, whether you're an EMT or paramedic in the back of an ambulance or in an ER setting or a primary care setting where a nurse asks that question and gets this answer back?
Sure. I appreciate that they do that. They do that in doctor's offices. OBGYN offices often have that on the forms that you fill out at the beginning, like, do you feel safe at home? However, it's important to recognize that often victims of domestic violence don't self-identify as victims.
Okay.
I've talked with people, actually, coincidentally, a woman who had broken her elbow and had stitches and extensive injuries did not identify as a victim of domestic violence or that they were unsafe. Often these victims feel that their injuries are a result of their own behavior.
Wow.
So we're not self-identifying as a victim. So if you are just like, this is clearly a domestic violence case, even if you don't feel like it's clearly a domestic violence case, it's important that you know the resources that are available in your area. You can Google domestic violence. You can Google safe house for your county, and you will find a hotline. You will find information about the agency that serves your county. Most counties, if we have like a more rural area, you'll have like one agency that will cover a larger area. But most of the time we see about one agency per county. They're going to offer a confidential hotline. Person doesn't even have to give their name. They're not going to tell them what to do or where to go. It used to be if you weren't willing to commit to leaving an abuser that they would say, well, then you have to call us back when you are. We can't offer you services. And thankfully, that's no longer the case. We've moved beyond that. So now it's just here are your options. People are going to be able to safety plan with them, which is very, very important. So whether they know the person's name or they're completely confidential, or they just call and say, I don't want to tell you anything, but I need to safety plan. They're going to give them some really creative ways to safety plan and things to prepare, things to think about that often people don't think about. So it's important just to know that hotline, to have palm cards available to be able to give to somebody. However, I'm going to kind of make a side note to that. When we have victims of domestic violence, sometimes we don't want to give them a tangible card to look at with a hotline number on it, because when that person, you know, if that person is back later on that day and that palm card or that information is found on them, that can escalate a situation and create an unsafe space for that person later.
Now, so, you say palm card, you mean just like a business card with the information for the hotline on it? You
know? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, often people, agencies, especially DV agencies, will have what we call palm cards with just like the hotline number on it and the name of the agency, or like a pamphlet or something like that. Sometimes you might suggest putting it like, you know, can you put this in your phone? Can you put it under a different name just so that you know that it's available? But sometimes just telling them, I want you to know that there are resources that are available just for our county. They'll safety plan with you. It's confidential. And if needed, they can also provide you a safe place to be. So I just wanted you to know that. You can look that up or ask somebody. You can call us here and we'll tell you that number later on if you want to. I don't want to give you a card because I don't want it to be found on you later, because maybe that would you know, makes things dangerous for you. Right. But I just want you to know that there are resources available.
But, you know, if it, for instance, if it were an 800 number or something like that, they could put it in and put their bank information down.
Absolutely.
Right. And it would just look like a bank phone number.
Yeah. So instead of saying, like, put that in your phone and just put it under a different name, be specific. You know, put the 800 number in and say PNC Bank or, you know, whatever credit card company you use, just put it in your phone under something else. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really a great idea. So you don't want to be taking steps to provide any kind of specific care to the abuse in the back of an ambulance or in the initial contact. You really need to get these people to specific services in the community that are trained to help these people with their specific problem.
Yeah, these agencies are filled with volunteers that will even, you know, if somebody expresses interest to, I want to connect with them, these agencies will also send out an advocate 24 hours a day to the hospital, to police departments. They'll accompany them to court, but they'll come to the hospital in the middle of the night and advocate for that person. They'll go to the police department with them and be with them while they make the taped statement or to help them understand the process for a restraining order, if that's what they want. Sometimes they are not going to want a victim because, again, we're going back to this idea that sometimes they don't identify as a victim, but just kind of planting that seed in their head that there are resources that are available. But maybe you'll have somebody that says, there's an advocate that would come with me here today because I'm really afraid. Absolutely. And the hospital will know what to do. They'll call that agency, and it's called a DVRT activation. Domestic Violence Response Team is invoked, and that person will come to the hospital.
That's fantastic. Now, I know this is something you do, Kim. As an advocate, what exactly do you advocate when you sit with that patient, maybe in an ER room, talking to a nurse and a doctor? Do you help them communicate effectively? Do you say, do you meet with the healthcare team before going in with the patient to help them understand the parameters of how they should approach this?
So there's typically two different agencies. Sometimes one agency is a dual agency that advocates for victims of domestic violence and sexual violence. And both are different certifications. So I am a DVRT and a part of the SART, Sexual Assault Response Team. So what 24 hours a day, there's an activation that occurs. We go to that hospital or that police department. So our role is out of the players of that team, the actors of that team, we are the only ones that are confidential. So we aren't going to be talking to hospital staff or to law enforcement or to family members unless our person wants us to. But our role is to kind of be their eyes and ears. The way that I kind of explain it is in that moment, you know, again, going back to the hospital with the domestic violence victim, they're in crisis. If they have sought treatment, they are in crisis. So often I do explain it as what they're hearing is white noise. People are talking and it's just like white noise in their head. And it's important that there are people around or an advocate that can say, do you understand what they were just saying? So what they're saying is that they're going to kind of give you a prescription for this and that they want you to call back later. Or if the police do come out, often that's a very heightened sense for that person when law enforcement is involved. So if they want, you know, they're talking to them about a temporary restraining order, and then what will happen later is we'll go to court and there'll be like, you know, a trial or a hearing for a permanent restraining order. These aren't things that are often able to soak in. So we're just going to be there to help them understand kind of what that process is. Okay. And sometimes it's just a matter of being in the room with them silently, just having somebody in the room to stand there and you know, to kind of be there for them and that they know that somebody is exclusively there for them. It can, you know, all sorts of things. The only time that we would talk to the healthcare provider, to law enforcement, with, you know, outside of the patient, is to say, you know, you're really kind of violating their boundaries when you say these things to them. We would really encourage you to use this type of language when, you know, really addressing a patient like this. And this is why that would be helpful for you. This is why it would be helpful for them. So we're not disclosing any information that the patient has given us, but helping that be a more positive. Yeah.
And actually what you're really saying is that the time for learning how to not violate these boundaries is really in training prior to when you get these patients. It really is reaching out to these resources way ahead of time and implementing across the board training for all your staff so that you can all be aware of what resources there are and how to best help these patients while you're managing their medical problem.
You can reach out to agencies. So my title is Sexual Assault Prevention Coordinator. So I offer all the outreach and education to a county. But the agencies that you have in your county or in your area often have outreach educators. You can call them as, you know, from your firehouse or from your police department, for whatever agency that you're working for, and say, we need some education. And I am not kidding. They will be thrilled mm-hmm. to come out and just kind of give you just some basic information. Maybe they even offer, you know, larger comprehensive programs if you're really willing to invest time. They are funded already to offer that to agencies. If you want that, they're going to come out. They're going to give it to you.
That's excellent. And that's good to know. I mean, we're always looking for different types of training than the standard, you know, stuff we have to do on our regular recertifications, especially in EMS. But this is something that's very specialized, and I think it's something that we are all missing and could use more of. So it's nice to know those resources are out there for us. So let's move forward to a little different side of things. We've been talking about domestic violence and sexual abuse. What about human trafficking? Because that's really a whole different thing and very yeah. pervasive. It's much more pervasive than I think any of us really are aware of.
It is. People hear human trafficking and they kind of think what we've seen in the media, you know, we've saw Taken, you know, we think that this is a foreign thing, or we think people are brought to this country from other countries and trafficked. And that does occur. Absolutely. So we see labor trafficking, we see human sex trafficking. But in my experience, more often than not, it's people younger, they're going to be children, usually recruited around the age of 13.
Wow.
And they are taken out of the suburbs, and within 24 hours, they're walking a track, which is trafficked out to a place, and they're walking the track as a sex worker. However, they're not a sex worker. This isn't a consensual situation. This is somebody that's been trafficked. But that's what we're really seeing is younger people from the suburbs, from cities, that are sometimes recruited by somebody that looks like a peer, sometimes maybe like a little bit older than them, especially when we see trafficked boys. We see maybe a 13-year-old adolescent is recruited by a 17-year-old adolescent who was previously trafficked his or herself.
Right.
This is something that is occurring very often. I don't have any data to be able to say how often these people reach out for treatment. Often I would think that the pimp or the trafficker is really their healthcare is just not even on their radar. Somebody is sick, somebody is injured. Whether or not that person lives or dies is really not a concern of theirs. But we do see traffickers, we do see victims of human trafficking, you know, in these situations. I can't tell you how often, but it is something that we need to be aware of. There's certain things that we need to look for. Like often when we have victims of human trafficking, the first thing that they ask for, and they don't usually ask for anything, is food. They're usually very malnourished.
Wow.
They've had food withheld for days and days. They're clearly dehydrated, and they want food. That's one of those first things that when we have somebody that's clearly like emaciated, we want to look at that. Not making eye contact, not being able to, or being resistant to give any kind of information like where they live, or if they say that they're in an area, you know, like, oh, do you live in this area? Oh, no, I'm just visiting. This is going to be one of those. Often we see branding. A lot of folks aren't familiar with signs of branding. So when we have human trafficking victims, they are branded by their pimps. We had a trafficker on the East Coast, actually not too long ago, that went by the name of God. So the branding tattoos, usually like appearing on the neck somewhere that can be seen, read things like Child of God, okay, or I am a Child of the King would be one, or Daddy's Girl, things like that. We want to look for signs of branding as well.
Wow. And that's, is that something that's specific to an area? So if we get an educator in from our local area, we may be able to actually get some idea of what kind of signs we're looking for with regard to local traffickers.
Yeah, a lot of states, for example, in the state of New Jersey, we have the Human Trafficking Task Force. They actually have a program education available for EMTs and first responders specifically. So we have EMTs and paramedics. They have that waiting, that education that they're wanting to offer. So I am not sure around the country, but human trafficking task forces are really available everywhere. So I don't know that we see them more often in other states. I know that I'm not really kind of sure what kind of season we're in right now, but for a long time we saw a lot of people being trafficked from the Midwest. So like Duluth, we were seeing a lot of folks from, and then trafficked out to either coast. So when we are on the coast, we're seeing like Atlantic City, Miami, New York. I was really kind of surprised to find out where Atlantic City fell in that list. And they were like, it was like the second most popular trafficking location on the East Coast, because we have the casinos are available there. We have people that are looking to spend money. And just like Vegas, when we have gambling communities like that, often sex work kind of go hand in hand. But there was a real trend around trafficking from the Midwest and going out. But we also have people right within counties within New Jersey being trafficked out to Atlantic City. You know, so not even really going far. But I don't have another way to explain it. It's a very successful business model. So we see a lot of gangs that were focused on drug trafficking are replacing drugs with human trafficking because they already have the network in place. Okay. So they're able to very easily move a stable, what is referred to as the trafficked victims, move a stable from place to place to place to place. So it's a drug that can be sold over and over and over and over and over again.
Wow. So it's really about getting yourself educated for what goes on in your community, but also generally educating yourself of just some basic things to watch for. And this is something I talk about on the shows all the time, is trust your instincts as a healthcare professional. You're doing this for a reason. It's because you care about people. You want to provide that care. And if something doesn't feel right, you're probably feeling the correct notion there. And that's been my experience. I've heard other people talk about it as well. So if something isn't quite right, start looking deeper. Don't dig with the patient deeper, but start opening your senses up and looking around and taking in other things. I remember a specific situation where the doorknobs were removed from a girl's bedroom door, and we just happened to see it in her home. And she was living with a mother and a stepfather, and we suspected abuse. She had some drug issues. We were there for an overdose, and it just so happened we had to go into her room because that's where she was. And I just thought it was weird. And when I got to the hospital, I made a comment to the nurse. This was back before I was a nurse. I was just an EMT at the time, and she went, "Wow, okay, well, I need to get a hold of somebody." Mm-hmm. She instantly recognized that, coupled with the drug abuse as other things, you know, this acting out, that is a sign of potentially that she was an abused child.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And then he had her doorknob removed so she couldn't lock her door.
Right.
Right? I mean, it made sense after the fact, but at the time, it just never registered until I got to the hospital. I just had to make a weird comment like, it was bizarre. There was no doorknob on the door.
Right. And then it kind of like clicked a little bit.
Yeah.
And picking up on those things, whether that's like an injury on somebody, something that they say, especially domestic violence victims or human trafficking victims might not overtly, tell you what's going on, but might say, like, give little clues, hoping that somebody will pick up on it. And of course, if we're talking about a child, which we're going to see more often than not when we're talking about human trafficking, it's important to know your agency's protocol and reporting, that there is a minor child. That's a mandated reporting situation that we want to make sure that we communicate to hospital staff and that they're going to reach out, just like what you did. We need to take those instincts, trust them, and move forward. Let the agency. So that's when we're going to call law enforcement. We're going to make that report, or it might be Department of Human Services for your area. Whatever your protocol is, you need to figure that out. Maybe you're wrong. Maybe you're right. It doesn't matter. you're the mandated reporter. You need to report that right. And then let them figure that and out. Is, let them investigate.
And I know in my case, both as a nurse and a paramedic, it is if I have a suspicion. It isn't if I know. It is if I have a suspicion. And that means if I have any kind of inkling that there's something wrong, I need to report it and let other people more knowledgeable than myself do the investigation.
Yeah, let them figure that out. We don't even need to worry about that. Just if we, and it's important to know that in all 50 states, a good faith call, you know, if we think that a good faith call, you are free from civil and criminal liability. You're making that call because a lot of people feel like, well, what if I'm wrong? That person could lose their job. And you know, especially get our personal lives, like we have a neighbor or something like that. We need to get that out of our multiple choice answers to not make the call. If we suspect, you make the call. Let the agency figure it out. That's not up to us.
Yeah, important stuff. Well, Kim, this is great. And maybe we should make this like a regular quarterly segment or something. I don't know. This is just, sure. There's so much more to cover here and so many things that we could go more in depth with each of these subjects. But I think this is an important place to really leave things where they are because people need to find the resources in their community right now. They need to go out and do that Google search, talk to their training officer, their resource officers, find out maybe somebody already knows these things and they're already recorded somewhere that the person's not aware of because they're new or it's never come up in their job. And so these are all things that we need to do right now and moving forward. Are there any final thoughts you'd like to share with our audience of EMTs, paramedics, nurses, and other health professionals?
Sure. So there's national resources as well as local resources. For sexual violence, I encourage people to go to nsvrc.org. So that's the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. Okay. They actually have printable materials directed specifically at healthcare providers when treating or suspecting sexual assault with a patient. We have RAINN, RAINN.org. That is a national organization. And all of these folks, you know, if you can't find your local resources, can direct you to local resources. There's national hotlines for human trafficking. If you just want more information, if you suspect something and you want some additional information or guidance on how to respond, that's what they're there for. They are funded to do that. They are happy to share that information with you. Get a hold of those, have them with you, have knowledge of them, have them in your own phone, just so you can share with folks that there are resources available for domestic violence victims, sexual violence victims, and human trafficking victims.
Excellent. Good news. And we will have all those links in the show notes for this episode. So you can head over to the site where you're watching this or listening to this and get those show notes and follow up on those links for yourself. Put them in your phone, put them in your bookmarks, whatever you need to do to make these resources readily available so that you have them at your beck and call when the time comes up. Because it's not a question of if you're going to run into one of these patients. Mm-hmm. Sadly, it's a question of just when or how soon the next one's going to come along. And that's sad to say, but it is incredibly pervasive, much more so than I think we understand.
Absolutely, yeah. We have violence as a cultural issue. When we look at statistics, we know that there are more victims of sexual violence than left-handed people, more than green-eyed people. So this is really a cultural issue. It just as what you said, it's not a matter of if, it's when. And if you've been in the field for a while, you've already been in contact with victims of all types of violence, but specifically DV, SV, and trafficking.
Great. Well, Kim, thanks a lot. We'll definitely have you back on. And it's great to recontact and reconnect with you.
Yeah, it was fun. I'm just really excited to have you really starting this conversation, or not starting it, but just perpetuating this and keeping this fresh and in front of people's minds. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. And I just love the work that you do. And I'm so excited to see you again and connect and collaborate with you. It's made my day.
That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show this week and, of course, remind you to follow up on all of the information you get in this week's show over at the MedicCast blog. That's at MedicCast.com/blog. Over there, you'll find a show notes link at the top of the page. Go ahead and take a moment and follow up on all of the information and links to news items and more you find there each week. You can also sign up for our email newsletter that'll bring you those links directly into your email inbox each week if you want. There's a form on the right-hand side of the page. Just go ahead and fill that out and you can get the MedicCast newsletter for yourself. I also welcome your comments and suggestions by email. So if you want to get back in touch with me, shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com. Send in your ideas for news links, ideas for future show topics or interviews, whatever comments you might have. I really do look forward to hearing from you, and I'll make sure I get back to you. I work hard to respond back to every email that comes in, so please keep those emails coming. If you want to catch up with me on social media and some of the pages and sites out there, you can find me at most places under the handle Podmedic. So you can catch me over at Twitter at twitter.com/podmedic or Facebook at facebook.com/podmedic. Friend or follow me over there. Also, don't forget to check out our MedicCast Facebook page. We now have over 5,000 followers, so head over to facebook.com/medicCast. Click the like button on the top of the page and join the community over there. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. Please make sure you spread the word and share the MedicCast with your colleagues and students and friends in the EMS world. I'll be back here each week with new episodes, new interviews, news items, tips, and more every Monday morning to start off your EMS week. Tell somebody else about the MedicCast today. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. It's time to close out the show. Don't forget to thank our sponsors. And remember, folks, Scene Safety, BSI.